I'll be speaking with Lori Marcus, an executive coach and advisor, as well as our directorship practice leader here at Crenshaw, where she guides executives on landing board roles. Recently, Lori co-authored the book, You Should Smile More, How to Dismantle Gender Bias in the Workplace. Lori has over 30 years of operating experience as CMO and other executive marketing roles and has significant board experience. She presently sits on the boards of Fresh Del Monte Produce, Primo Water, and 24 Hour Fitness. In our conversation, we'll be touching on her experience as a director, the current landscape for executives seeking to become board members, and how boards can address gender bias in the workplace and in the boardroom. Lori, why don't we start with this? In working with Crenshaw clients, what can executives expect in their search for a board role, and what kind of commitment would they need to make to optimize the engagement?
Yeah, so I think there's two things, Bill. I think the first thing is the commitment and what people can expect in terms of searching for a board. And then there's a like a sort of a different answer about what they should actually expect when they are invited to serve on a board and the commitment associated with that. So I think in terms of the work that we do with clients in terms of helping them prepare themselves for board service, market themselves for board service, what I would say is it's one of the things I like very much about Crenshaw is our approach is very much like job search in terms of the intensity of it, the rigor around it, the assessments that we do to help people understand themselves, the marketing themselves, understanding themselves as a brand, you know, their headwinds, their tailwinds, their main messages, their vignettes, all of that. It's really very much a similar process that Crenshaw has used for almost 40 years in terms of high-end job search. The commitment itself, we always say we highly concierge it for people, professional resume writer, professional bio writer, professional LinkedIn, an expert to help them with their messaging. But we can't do it for them, right? We can't do the networking for them. So people really have to put in a commitment. I tell them to think about it as though they were searching for a job. It's much like job search. You've got to put in hours of work a week to land a board role. And then, of course, we can talk about once somebody does land a board role, the commitment that's involved in that.
And how would our program differentiate from some of the programs given by the Ivy League schools?
So I think there's two things. I think our program is probably 90% about preparing yourself for board service, like I said, in terms of documents, understand your messaging, you know, resume, bio, LinkedIn, all of that. We teach people how to network. I mean, it's really all about preparation and then marketing yourselves. We help people with mailings out to all the recruiters in the field. Like I said, we help them with their networking. But 90% of our program is really about getting themselves prepared and marketing themselves for board search. Probably 10% of our program is actually teaching people about governance. We do a governance academy. We do an academy around private equity. So it's 90% around helping them to get on a board and then a little bit about like actual governance. I think some of the programs like you're mentioning, I think they're very complementary to what we do, whether it's at Northwestern or Wharton or Harvard. Those programs are 95% about teaching people about governance and committees and kind of the ins and outs of actually serving on a board. And they might have like a couple of hours about how to write a board bio or how to write a board resume. It's kind of the actual opposite or the inverse of what we do. So I think they complement each other nicely. But what I always tell our clients is I love those programs. I highly recommend them as a complement to what we do. But knowing about governance doesn't get you on a board. Right? You still have to get out there and you have to market the heck out of yourself and network to actually let the world know, recruiters, other people you know, that you're interested in board service, and then really work hard to get yourself on a board.
And so for sitting executives, how should they think about how it benefits their career by sitting on a board? And at the same time, how do we talk to corporations about why it's a worthwhile investment for those executives?
I think serving on a board is an unbelievable critical experience for senior executives. I mean, if you think about we talk a lot about critical experiences, but critical experiences are sort of normally limited by what you can get within your own company. You know, you move jobs maybe every 2 years, every 2.5 years, every 3 years. The unbelievable thing about a board, when you think about not just meeting other people and developing sort of a kind of a personal network, but think about you can work in other industries, you can work in other companies at different stages of growth, whether it's raising capital, acquiring companies, divesting different divisions. Regardless of what function you're in your day job, when you're in a board, you're responsible for looking across the whole corporation. I mean, I'm a marketer by background. I don't just opine on the marketing issues on a board. You're there for the full complement of governance. So I think in terms of skills, critical experiences, the people you meet, types of industries that you can be associated with, and then different things that happen to companies, and that might be CEO succession. It may be there's an activist investor. It may be there's the cyber attack. And so all these different things, you get to have those critical experiences while still mastering the day job that you're doing with your company.
Lauren, speaking about the benefit to corporations, I don't know if you remember when we were at Pepsi years ago, Roger Enrico, who was chairman, came back from a Dayton Hudson, owner of Target. And all of a sudden, Power of One was invented at PepsiCo. And the reason was they were at a meeting and they were talking about merchandising. And all of a sudden, he thought about chips and soda on the same display and what kind of turns they could create for the corporate, you know, for the company and the benefits there.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of benefit in terms of the thinking and learning you can get on a board.
Absolutely. And the other thing that happens in a corporation is, I mean, even if you have a very big job in a company, the world of people that you deal with kind of week in and week out, it starts to get small. I mean, it's a group of customers, it's a group of peers, it's a group of people that might work on your team. One of the amazing things on a board is if you think about it, so you're on a board, call it with 8 or 9 other people, those people come to board service with a whole career of experiences and different points of view. So in terms of kind of just radically opening up your mind to different perspectives, different points of view, different experiences, it's a way to supercharge that for an executive, because you can't give an executive a new assignment every month. I mean, you just can't. They have to stay in role long enough to really learn things, to, you know, to overlap their success and all of that. But this is a way of almost supercharging their experience, both in terms of the situations and the people that they're dealing with.
You know, in fact, Tom Stenberg, who's a co-founder of Staples, told me, when you're thinking about a board, pick a board and the folks on the board that you can learn from.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so give me 2 examples of things that you've been exposed to or learned over the past couple of years on your board.
Every time I go to a board meeting, I come away and I am so humbled by how much I learn from the other people that I sit on the board with. And I'm not being sort of dramatic for any reason. So, you know, one is I sit on the audit committee of Fresh Del Monte Produce, which is a publicly traded company. And, you know, I'm a chief marketing officer by background. I'm not an audit partner at a Big 4 accounting and consulting firm. And so I watch constantly our audit chair, a terribly talented woman by the name of Marianne Cloyd. I watch not just how she prepares for the meetings and how she conducts herself in the meetings, but what I also love is for weeks after every meeting, we'll get notes from her, emails from her. I've been reflecting about this, or I've been thinking about that. And so she looks at the world through like a managing risk perspective, which is not the way I was necessarily trained as a marketer working in consumer products, where you're trained, I mean, a lot of business analytics, but you're also trained with a lot of optimism and what can happen. And when you serve on a board, part of it is you really do oversee risk management. So I feel like serving on an audit committee board, on the audit committee of a board, in addition to really sort of honing your skills in terms of getting deep into financial statements, it really helps me think about, like I said, about risk and how to think about risk, not just in a short-term basis, but on a long-term basis as well.
As executives think about their first board role or their second board role and they're in a search, what experiences would stand out and differentiate them?
So we always tell our clients to think about, you know, there's a set of experiences that you have as an executive that are really appropriate when you're looking for a job. So, you know, if I were looking for a chief marketing officer role, I would certainly be talking about new products that I created or commercials that I had done, things like that. But what boards are really looking for when you're interviewing for boards, they really want to think about, I would say, two broad categories. One is think about the things that you would do if you were on a board. So simply stated, management succession or hiring and firing the CEO, overseeing long-term strategy, and then kind of guiding risk management. What we encourage people to do is think about their experiences through that lens. And so a good example I always use is I have a CHRO client. If she were interviewing for another CHRO client, she might talk about how she implemented a new HRIS system. It saved the company $2.7 million a year, and it was very effective. That's probably not her best vignette for interviewing for a board. For a board, they're going to be much more interested in the role that she played in CEO succession, in when they did a full board succession and really overhaul their entire board, and then also the role that she plays running the HR committee with their board quarter after quarter. An executive should think about their experiences, but look at it through two lenses. One is, what do boards do and how do they think about positioning their experiences so they're very much like what a board does? And then the second thing is they should really think about their own board experience. Could be not-for-profit boards, but also if you're a very senior executive, what role do you play with your own company board? Do you present to the board? Do you attend the committee meetings? Are you responsible for running committee meetings? First thing the executive recruiter will typically ask is, have you ever met with your board? Have you ever presented to your board? So don't wait for them to ask that question. We always tell people, think about what experiences you've had in the boardroom already.
Lori, it seems like there are a number of transitions an executive needs to make to serve on a board. Knowing the difference between being a board member and an operating executive be one of the top.
Yes. I'm laughing because I always coach people that is the definition of a softball question. When an executive recruiter or the head of a nominating and governance committee would say, you know, Lori, do you understand the difference between being a board member and being an operating executive? That is the definition of a softball. And I'm laughing because early in my board tenure, I interview for board roles and I flubbed that question so badly. Now it's so obvious to me. So as an operating executive, you are responsible. You run the company. I mean, even if you're not the CEO, you run a functional area, you run supply chain or IT or marketing or sales. You are responsible for, you know, you write the strategy, the three-year strategy, you write the annual operating plan, and then you are responsible for executing day in and day out against that. So that's an operating executive, and you're very much, even though you do long-term strategy, you are in the day-to-day, and most importantly, you own execution and you own the results. When you think about a board member, what does a board do? Overall, it's governance, right? So again, they hire and fire the CEO, or said more eloquently, management succession. They guide long-term strategy, and they're responsible for overseeing risk management. So nowhere in there are you day in and day out executing. You're not at the 6 a.m. sales meeting, you know, with the driver salesman on a Tuesday morning. You're not making decisions about which manager gets promoted or which director is going to move to assignments. You're not running the company day to day. It's really governance and oversight. And so I think for some executives, that is such a welcome change, whether they're a sitting executive or a former sitting executive, it's a real welcome change. For others, it's a real difficult mindset change. They want to run the company. They want to get in there. They want to do the stuff. And I have to remind people, the way that you quote unquote do the stuff is by putting the right CEO in place, making sure there's the right senior team around the CEO, figuring out what you're going to pay the CEO and the senior leadership team. And then you can ask a lot of questions, but you don't run the company day in and day out. And it's very different for most people who have spent 20, 30, 40 years actually being operating executives.
In terms of overall time commitment, given the number of disruptions, compliance, changes in business models today, probably at a speed greater than any time previously, how should the executives think about the time commitment that they need to make to serve on a board?
Yeah, the time commitment is real. So I laugh when people say like, oh, it's such a good gig. It's 4 meetings a year times 2 days each. It's 8 days a year and that's it. That is so far from reality. So if you think about it, sort of the minimum time, right? So you do attend physical board meetings, call it 4 to 6 times a year. And those are typically 2+ days plus travel. That's kind of the minimum. That's just getting people started. Then to your point, the CEO announces he or she is going to retire. There is a cyber attack. There's a bad press it's happening. There's a private company and somebody announces that they want to come in and put in an offer to the company. These things happen sort of month in and month out. There are special committees that arise as a result of these things. So I read someplace that somebody should assume that they're going to spend 200 to 300 hours a year on board service. But when you add up all the committee meetings, the board meetings, these kind of special things that happen, both good as well as sometimes not so good, like a cyber attack, it's a real commitment. And it's something that people have to really very seriously think about in light of if they are also doing the job as an operating executive by day or if they have other commitments.
Lori, as I said in the introduction, you've now co-authored a book, You Should Smile More, How to Dismantle Gender Bias in the Workplace, with some terrific women that I knew and you work with at Pepsi. How did it come about?
We did not set out to write a book. It was nowhere in my plan of what I was going to do in this portfolio career where I wanted to do board service and executive coaching. I had no plan to write a book. It actually came about in a beautiful, organic way. We were at a dinner about 4 years ago with Indra Nooyi, who had just stepped down as the CEO and chair of the board at PepsiCo. She had recently retired. And we were at a small group dinner, about 5 or 6 of us. And we got onto this discussion. I don't remember how we even started talking about how almost 30 years prior, I was one of the original founders of the Women's Resource Network, the first ever Women's Resource Network at Pepsi. So we were talking about that. And then we also got talking about the little things that used to happen at work, not just at PepsiCo, but at other places as well, that made us feel like we couldn't bring our full selves to work. And they were just little things that nobody ever talked to, being asked to take the notes in meetings or being called a girl versus a woman at work or being asked to plan the parties or people not putting you up for promotion because they just assumed because you had small children, you wouldn't be able to do the travel. And we started talking about these things that we had never talked about before. And then we kept talking about them. We talked about them at dinner. We talked about them in meetings afterwards. And finally, what we realized was complaining about these things and sort of realizing that they were still happening, you know, complaining about them doesn't do anything. We had this realization that we all had a voice, we had power, we had sort of a seat that we could use our voices to actually do something rather than just talking about gender bias in the workplace. Maybe we could actually use our power, our voices, our platforms to try and dismantle gender bias in the workplace. So that's how it got started. We were out, we were doing some speaking. It really resonated. And we thought, this was 2019, early 2020. We thought, okay, we'll go out, we'll speak, we'll collect stories. At some point, maybe down the road, who knows, maybe we'll write a book. COVID happened, all our speaking engagements got canceled. And so what we said is, let's just flip the script. Instead of going out and speaking for 2 years and collecting stories and maybe writing a book, let's spend the time while we're in quarantine. We thought it was going to be 6 months. We didn't realize it was going to be 2 years that we were in quarantine. And we used that time to go out. We did primary interviews with about, I'd say, hundreds of women ages probably 25 to 45. And we said, okay, let's write the book while we're in quarantine. And then when we ever get out of our houses, then we'll go out and we'll tell our stories to major corporations all over the country.
I don't know if you remember this, but when Brenda Barnes became CEO of Pepsi North America, she said there are going to be no more golf at at Pepsi meetings. And so maybe she was the genesis of all this.
I'm laughing because I just recorded a podcast last week and I told two Brenda Barnes stories in that podcast. So I feel like that's sort of my my thing is I'm always telling Brenda Barnes stories. I think she was so ahead of her time, including things like at the time working in a very sort of a route-based business, you know, the Pepsi business where there's driver salesmen selling cases of soda up and down the street in convenience stores and little independent businesses. It's a very male-dominated business. It's a very physical business. That's just an is statement. Well, as a result of that, we had very few women in sales overall. And Brenda is a great example of somebody who said, that's just an artificial barrier. Just because women aren't driving the trucks and, you know, slinging cases, as we used to say, doesn't mean we shouldn't have women in sales and territory managers. And she realized at the time she was the COO, maybe the president, whatever her exact role was. But she said by X amount of time, maybe it was years, 18 months, you might remember, she said, we're going to have two women in every territory in management in the country, however many there were. I don't remember if there were 20 or 40 or 60 or 100, but she said, we're just going to do it. And she was, it was a great example of she had the leadership, she had the power. And she said, there's all these excuses of why it doesn't happen. We're just going to do it. We're going to change it. And lo and behold, like they put the metrics in place and every territory had two women in management at the end of whatever it was, 18 to 24 months. So I think in many ways she was, you know, so far ahead of her time. And of course, like she did everything with such grace and class and style and warmth.
She sure did. When you think about the topics in the book mm-hmm. or the book itself, how do you think about it as a sitting director?
Mm-hmm. So the book is about, very briefly, it's as the title would suggest, it's about how to dismantle gender bias in the workplace. And it's a very practical guide for women who experience some of these micro moments or microaggressions, as people call them. For women who experience them, what can you say or do in the moment, after the meeting, before the next meeting, as well as for allies of any gender who are bystanders? How do you go from being a bystander to an ally of any gender? And then for bosses or leaders of any gender, what can you say or do? So that's the book. It's extremely practical. We cite a lot of academic research, but we're operators, we're not academics. So it's very practical. And what I would say is from a board perspective, it really hits me in two ways. One is when you're on a board is an ecosystem in and of itself. So you experience gender bias on a board. I mean, you do. I was on a board. We were doing CEO succession. You know, editor's note, there's a whole section in the book about lazy language and things people say that are just lazy. So they'll say things like, you'll be at a people planning session and they'll say, he's a great guy. Well, what does that mean? Where is great guy on the sales competency model or the finance competency model? So we'll say things like, he's a great guy, but then we'll say for women, well, did she meet her objectives? Did she meet her sales goals? What did she achieve? So there's things like that where people just say things that are sort of not specific, not very helpful. They tend to be kind of aggrandizing for men, and they tend to hold women back a little bit. So here I am. I'm on a board. We're about to do a search for a new director. And two things happened. One is in the first meeting where we were talking about it, one of the guys just says, literally, I got a guy. As though it were like a guy to put like shower doors on my new bathroom. Like, what do you mean I got a guy? What does that mean? Not, oh, I know a talented executive who would be good on our board who has experience in cybersecurity. Or I know someone that has public company board experience that would be really good. It was just like, I got a guy. And it was very much that sort of thing that everyone talks about where people just want to surround themselves with people that they know that are like them. So I think there are times like that where you experience gender bias. Or one other example on another board, we were interviewing to add another board member. We were working with a very reputable search firm, and there were six candidates we were looking at. Three happened to be men and three were women. And without realizing it, one of the folks on our board, for every woman, he would ask the recruiter, well, why did she leave that role that you're talking about? Was she fired or did she leave on her own? And he asked it for every one of the women, and he didn't ask it for any of the men. Now, I guarantee you he was not doing that on purpose. I guarantee you he was not even conscious of it. And so this is the point. I had a moment there. I was relatively new on the board. I didn't have a lot of psychological safety. I didn't have a lot of tenure on the board, but I just thought, when you're in the room and you're there, you have to use your power. You have to use your voice. So I just said in the nicest possible way, we'll call him Dave. And I said, Dave, I'm sure you don't realize this, but for all the women candidates, you're asking the recruiter to explain the transition and you're not doing it for any of the male candidates. So let's just make a pact with us. Let's either ask it for all the candidates or none of the candidates. And I was kind of nervous saying it because, again, I didn't really have the tenure or the psychological safety. And of course, the funny thing is one of the other people on the call, one of the other board directors just texted me and he said, that might be the most helpful thing anyone on our board has ever said. So the point is, those are two examples where I was a board member and I was experiencing gender bias. And it was unconscious bias. The people that were saying the things, they weren't saying it on purpose. They weren't waking up in the morning trying to hold women back. So that's one way you experience it, that you actually experience gender bias in the ecosystem that is the board. The second way you experience is as you're doing oversight of the company, you watch things that happen in the company that are examples of gender bias. And so then you have a different role to play, which is ask the questions and use your voice to make sure that it's not perpetuated.
And how do you see the change taking place, or is it taking place?
I'm an optimist by nature, so I like to point to the positives. What I would say is, so over the past 30 years, I would say it's gone from sort of very blatant gender bias to very nuanced gender bias. I don't see people saying to a board member or to a senior executive, like, sweetie, can you get me a cup of coffee, right? We don't have that anymore. It's not Mad Men. It's not the 1950s. But it's very nuanced is what we see now. So in some ways, it's a little bit harder because you have to see it. You have to have the productive language to be able to call it out in a way that invites people into the conversation, not that makes them feel defensive. So I think it's changing slowly. And a big focus of the book and of the work that we do out with companies is really about inviting men into the conversation.
I was just going to ask that in terms of...
Absolutely. Absolutely. We first started, we wrote the book. And again, the book is called You Should Smile More. It's cheeky. Women get it. Women have the same reaction when they see the book. They go, ugh. If I had a dollar for every time I was told to smile more, I'd have a lot of dollars. And men say things like, oh, you should smile more. That's a great idea. People should smile more. And of course, I have to say, yes, that's true, but not the point. So the point is the book was written with women in mind. And very quickly, as soon as we got out there and we started speaking, it became very clear to us that nothing changes if only women are in this. So what you have to do is you have to call men into the conversation, invite men in, invite people of every gender in, if they're allies, if they're bosses, to be part of the conversation and to actually help to dismantle gender bias. It can't just be the women that are doing it. By definition, most board seats are filled by men. Most senior executives, most CEOs in today's world, the vast majority are men. And so you have to have men in the conversation committed to understanding and then finding the right things to do and say that will one by one, like meeting by meeting by meeting, have fewer microaggressions start to happen. And that's really the most important thing that we tell people is, every company has gender bias. If you breathe, you have unconscious bias. It's not a bad thing. Everybody has unconscious bias. So it's making yourself aware of it and then thinking about what you can say or do. But these little micro moments or these little things, they happen one by one by one by one by one, and then they add up. So the way that you dismantle it is not in some big sweeping gesture. It's one action, one word in every single meeting, every single interaction that you're in.
It becomes cultural. It's not an initiative.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that makes it sustainable once you have it ingrained in the culture.
Exactly. Absolutely. And a big piece of that, I love when you talk about culture, is a big piece of this. People always ask me, like, I as a senior male leader, what can I do? And one of the most important things that you can do is create an environment where people can speak truth to power. And that's cultural. And they can tell you, hey, Bill, you may not realize this, but when you X, it makes me feel Y. Or I know you're not doing this on purpose, but can I just call something to your attention? And then you, Bill, have the opportunity to say, yes, please, gosh, I didn't realize that. I'm gonna do better at that. I'm gonna stop doing that thing. Versus if you say, well, I didn't mean that, and then you just squash it. And what you basically taught me is don't speak truth to power. So I think as the biggest piece of culture is, are you a culture of learning, not just learning about the business, but learning about your culture and becoming a better and more productive culture. And that's why dismantling gender bias is so intertwined with culture. But you're 100% right. It's not an initiative.
In fact, one of the lessons I learned was from some woman I was working with at Pepsi, who said to me, Bill, you can't leave these voicemails on weekends. And I said, I'm not going to say your name, but I said, but when you ask me, tell me you're taking off a day, I never say anything. And you said, that's true. But when you leave voicemails on weekends, then people think that you're expecting to get a response right away. So I learned lessons.
Well, that sounds like a very wise woman that you worked with.
Very wise. But I would say that I did the same thing for men and women.
There you go.
Lori, the last question, quick, is I know people have asked this. Ex-Pepsi executives, men, have said, where am I in the book? And maybe I've learned that I actually don't want to be in this book.
So I'm going to tell you a story that I tell all the time when we speak. And, you know, we've been out all over the country speaking to major corporations. And so there's a chapter in the book that's called Not Just Mentors, Get Sponsors. And it's something I use in my coaching all the time. It's not just for women. It's about the importance of having sponsors. Women tend to be over-mentored and under-sponsored. And so one of the things that we do is we talk to people and we explain the difference between a mentor, a coach, and a sponsor. And the biggest thing, the easiest thing to remember, is a sponsor is someone who has power and they use their power when you're not in the room, and they advocate for you and they pull for you and they use their power, their voice, to help pull you through the organization. Everybody at every level of every gender, everybody needs sponsorship. So take that as that's just true. And one of the things that I say when we're out speaking, I can't remember if it's in the book or not, is that sponsors, they don't always look like what you think they're going to look like in a Hallmark movie. So sponsors aren't always the people put their hand on their shoulder and say, oh, Lori, you're doing such a good job, blah, blah, blah. Sponsors are sometimes people that push and push and push and push you. And sometimes they push you really hard because they see potential in you even before you see it in themselves. And so, Bill Glenn, I will say to you that that is where you are referenced, maybe in the book, but definitely in all the speaking, which is early on in my career. And we worked together at Pepsi. You pushed me really hard. You weren't always like the nicest to me. You weren't coddling to me in any way. You pushed and you pushed and you pushed. And you were also responsible for using your power at a very important part in my career to help me get to a very important executive level. And I realized after the fact that you pushed me so hard because you saw potential in me that I didn't even see in myself. So that is Mystery Explained, everybody. That's where Bill Glenn is in the book, which is sponsors are really important to everyone, but don't mistake somebody being sweet and kind and nice to you to being a sponsor. There's plenty of people that have been super nice to me in my career that have never lifted a finger or used their voice to help me get to where I really needed to go.
Thanks, Laura. This is, again, a great read, really good lessons for men and women. Thanks.
Thanks, Bill.